Over to you.
I'm a second year classics student at Queen's, and I started to follow Jesus at the end of last year, last summer. I started looking into Christian faith about this time last year, and I'd only ever had any sort of academic interest in it up till then, really. But I mean, it was enough to persuade me to come along to a talk sort of like this one, really. And on the back of that, I was interested. I had a look at a couple of books that some Christian friends had lent me, and I just realized as I read them, just in fairly slowly, sort of a chapter a night, or just on a train journey or something, I realized that I, despite several years of Sunday chapel and such like at school, I never really understood the message of Christ. I never realized that it wasn't about what I could do for him. It was about what he had done for me by dying on the cross for me. And then when I read through a copy of Mark's Gospel, I was really struck by the power and the compassion of Jesus. All the way through this, I had this sort of wall of questions in front of me. And as I asked various friends my questions, they were all answered. And they were all answered in a way that seemed reasonable and what seemed correct to me. And I mean, in May week last year, I was having supper with a couple of friends, and I sort of realized two very important things. I mean, the first one was that Christ really is God. So I couldn't look at Jesus without considering God. And also, the same in reverse. I couldn't look at God without sort of independent of Jesus. And the second thing I realized was that I did need to make a choice. And yes, it was a choice that I needed to consider very carefully, and I did. But I couldn't sit on the fence with Christ. Doing that is rejecting him. And so I made the choice in May week last year that I believed was right, to follow Jesus. And now that I've been living for Jesus, trusting in him, I really can say I've never been happier. And when I look back on it, I think all my mistakes, all the things ways I've been horrible to God, I've been completely forgiven for them, and that I can now have a perfect relationship with God, and I can have it forever. And this is because of the work that Christ has done on the cross, dying for me, for humanity, and in his work in me over the last year. And because of this, I can have this relationship forever. And it's wonderful. I'm going to read the passage for tonight's talk now. It's on page 24 of the Gospels that you've got. It's Mark chapter 8. We're going to start at verse 27, so that's about halfway down the page. It's page 24. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, he asked them, "Who do people say I am?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others, one of the prophets." "But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Peter answered, "You are the Christ." Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about him. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed, and after 3 days rise again. He spoke plainly about this, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But when Jesus turned and looked at his disciples, he rebuked Peter. "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Then he called the crowd to him, along with his disciples, and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels."
Thanks, Adam. That's great. Well, Philip Jensen's here with us once again, and the question we're particularly looking at is, who do you say I am? So I'm just going to pass straight over to him.
Thank you, Barnaby and Adam. I've been in this country now for about 6 weeks, and I've not once raised the subject of cricket. But now that you have started to regain some confidence after your win in the one-day competition, I feel that I'm not kicking a man when he's down. Just to mention the unmentionable word, ashes. So tonight I'm going to speak of ashes. Not the recent boring and desultory series in Australia, but your ashes. No, not the magnificent and cliffhanging series of the previous season in England, but of your ashes. The ones that are yours and yours alone, that can never be taken away from you, even by an Australian 11. Well, it's great to see you here again. In the third of our evening series of talks on cross-examined. Over these 6 nights, we're examining the cross of Jesus by looking at key moments in the Gospel of Mark. As we examine the cross of Jesus, we keep finding that we are the ones being cross-examined. It's one of the great problems people have dealing with God, that when you get God in the dock, you discover that actually he's on the bench and you are the one in the dock. Your thoughts on God are not nearly as eternally significant as God's thoughts on you. It's not that you can actually control your investigation of someone who is greater than you. And so Jesus asks you all kinds of questions that are more penetrating, difficult, profound than the questions you want to ask of him. Tonight's question is, who do you say I am? And there are some subsequent questions that Jesus poses on the basis of that. Now I hope you'll keep coming to each talk right through to Saturday night. But first of all, I want to say congratulations for being here tonight. But let me encourage you to keep coming and keep taking steps of inquiry. Come to the other meetings, read one of the books available on the stall, read through Mark's Gospel. Come to the cross-examined series that is starting up next week. There's a leaflet like this, purpley coloured, mauvey coloured, that you can pick up on the door of the way out, where there is discussion groups happening starting next week for the rest of term. Come to one of those. Or in the little pad of papers there on your desk, on your seat tonight, there's this little cross-examined response slip, and there's all kinds of options there for you to tick about being in touch with the KICU group or meeting informally with a Christian, or there's options for you. Follow up what you're doing, and if you're ready tonight to be praying to become a Christian, as Adam was last May, then you'll see there's a little prayer, a slip that's there, usually in the back of the Mark's Gospel, that I'm going to be praying tonight as I pray at the end of each of these talks, giving you an opportunity to do business with God tonight before you even leave this hall. I'd like everybody to do that, but I know some of us aren't ready to do it. And so I'll indicate as we go through tonight some places at which you might like to get off the train and say, okay, I can't go all the way down the journey yet, but that's a good place to stop so that I can think more. If for no other reason than that Jesus is the single most dominant figure in Western history, and that he is the person that more people around the world follow than any other person, it would be important for an educated person to have reached some opinion on tonight's question. Who do you think I am? Who is Jesus? Or who was Jesus? Why did he come? To have no real opinion on Jesus is a sad comment on our modern, secularist, politically correct educational system that will not allow the name of Jesus so much as to be discussed in many classrooms. The most widely followed man in the world, who has influenced Western civilization more than any other man, is not allowed in discussion in schools. Maybe not your school, but in many schools. That says a lot about censorship, doesn't it? Back in 1988, at the University of New South Wales, we did a survey. We often did these surveys. These are just the figures that I have in my computer to carry with me, but I could do it for other years as well. We asked a series of questions. Amongst them was the question, in your own opinion, and we emphasised that and taught the questioners to emphasise that, who do you think Jesus was? There were four kinds of answers we got. There were very positive ones, like he was the prophet, he was the Christ, he was the Saviour, he was God, he was the King. There were others that you might say are positive in that they are consistent with the Christian teaching, such as fisherman or carpenter, though not of that kind of really positive. And then there were the negative ones, the people who said, oh, he's a myth, or he's a legend, he was a fake, he was a phony. And then there are others that we can't spell miscellaneous, so we put as neutral. That is, he has no idea, he was a founder of a religion, things that, well, neutral is the best way to drop them. And you can see that 60% of the population had a very positive attitude towards Jesus. 69, nearly 70% were basically positive. When we asked this question, one of the things that was interesting was that 91% of the people we surveyed had an opinion and gave it. Only 9% fell in the category of no idea. Everybody basically has an idea as to who Jesus is. But later in the survey, many questions later, tucked away so people didn't connect the two things, we asked another question, which was, of the 27 books of the New Testament, how many have you read? Well, those who were very positive about who Jesus was, 43% hadn't read any. 70% had read less than five. And those who were just positive, well, two-thirds of them hadn't read any, and over 90% had read less than five. Those who were negative, well, it was much the same, 68 and 91. In fact, a little bit better, you might say. And those who didn't know, well, they were much the same as well. That is, two-thirds of the people who answered had not read the basic text. The most positive answers had read most, which is not surprising because there must have been some Christians in amongst the group, but even them, only 70% of them had read up to five books. The most negative answers had read the least. Again, that's not surprising, although frankly it was not statistically significant. But if Jesus is one of the is the one Christians claim him to be, if he's come to do what Christians claim that he came to do, and it's pretty critically important to answer the question, who is he? And if 91% of the population is going to answer and say, oh, he's so-and-so, it is astonishing to find that 90% of them have not read even but a smattering of the New Testament. I mean, it's not all that hard to get a copy of the New Testament, is it? I mean, we give them away. In fact, people get upset we give them away. They're readily available. It's not as if one book is a very long book to read. I'm not cracking any engineer jokes tonight. Far too many social workers wrote saying to me about engineers having feelings for me to continue my barrage on engineers. Whenever I tell that to an engineer, they laugh at social workers. However, I won't tell. That's a social work joke. That's not an engineer joke, isn't it? That's a risky one, though, because the social workers do have feelings. So, it's not as if it's a hard read, friends. It's readily available. But the classic undergraduate answer in Australia, of course, not Cambridge. The classic undergraduate answer as to who is Jesus is based on ignorance, not fact. It's based on not having read the most basic, readily available, easily readable historical documents about the man. Many people, you see, they've made their decision about God and Christianity when they were children. And though they've become adults, and what we're dealing with in the Bible is very adult, they've never reviewed their opinions. That's why I say congratulations, you're here. And I mean it. It's not just phony kind of warm, fuzzy feelings. I'm really glad you're here. Because this is something we need to consider. That's why I want you to keep coming and think further, because I don't really expect in one lecture one night that you will have heard all that you need to hear to make a real adult and genuine evaluation of the question, who is Jesus? Tonight we're getting to the heart of Mark's Gospel when we come to the turning point at the end of chapter 8. Chapters 1 to 8 have been asking and answering the question, who is Jesus? Then chapters 9 to 16 ask and answer the question, why did Jesus come? But throughout the Gospel, there is a third theme question that is constantly being asked, that is, what does Jesus require? And so in each chapter, you can find, what does Jesus require of you? Here at the end of chapter 8, then, is the turning point, where for the first time in the Gospel, Jesus is identified for who he is, for the disciples work out the right answer, you are the Christ. And so then Jesus starts to tell them why he has come and what is to be required of them in the light of why he has come. So tonight I'm planning four headings. Who, why, what, and why. You would think that with four I could have come up with four different ones, but my mental capabilities were not able to go for a different one under number four, because after all I am an Antipodean colonial. So the best I could come up with is why one and why two, and I thought, well, we don't need to do that. My aim through the night will not be to give my answers particularly, but the answers to the questions that we find in this very passage that we just read on page 24, so I hope you have it open in front of you. That is, the answers that were given in the first place by Jesus, as recorded in Mark's Gospel. Well, let's get back to it then. Jesus asks the question, who do people say that I am? It's the real turning point. Publicly, he hasn't been ever asking the question, though others have been asking the question. No one so far has given the right answer. And so we see the disciples giving the answers that people gave, the ancient answers in verse 28. Well, some John the Baptist. Others say you're Elijah. Others say you're one of the prophets. They were the normal kinds of answers you could expect in first century Palestine. John the Baptist was a prophet of the time, which we can read about outside the New Testament as well as inside the New Testament. He's recorded in Josephus, the Jewish historian of the time. John the Baptist was beheaded by King Herod. He was denouncing King Herod for his adultery, because Herod had adulterously taken his brother's wife as his wife. She didn't like John, and so she persuaded Herod to have John beheaded. And Herod, when he heard of Jesus coming and doing the things that John had been doing, was spooked by Jesus and thought that it was John the Baptist come back from the dead to have vengeance upon him. We know the Herodian family, a very sick, immoral, degenerate, corrupt regime, full of superstitions, not surprising that he thought that. Elijah, yes, in the Old Testament, the prophets said that there would be a day coming before the end when Elijah would come. And so the people who were looking for the day of God were looking for the Elijah. Was Jesus the Elijah? That could be the answer. And others said, well, no, he's a prophet. John the Baptist is a prophet. We know other prophets are coming. He's doing the things prophets do. If we ask those questions today, walking out in the streets of Cambridge, I guarantee you wouldn't get those answers. The University of New South Wales survey and the other surveys I've seen conducted, we've never had anybody say Jesus was John the Baptist come back from the dead. We've never had anybody say he was Elijah either, though we do get people saying he's a prophet. We get the range from God to Messiah to Savior to Lord to good man, prophet, teacher of religion, founder of religion, a legend, a myth, a nuisance. But, of course, the key question that we always need to follow up is, how do you know? On what evidence have you got that he is the Christ? On what evidence have you got that he was a myth? I mean, the answer's a nice answer, but the follow-up question is the deadly one for the average undergraduate. On what evidence have you got that you've come to this conclusion? They're hardly ever ready for that question because there's such little research and inquiry done. But in the end, there's only a limited range of modern alternatives, modern answers. You can say, in the old classic things, he was mad, he was bad, he was God. Or if you're into alliterations, he was the lunatic, he was a liar, he was a legend, he was the Lord. They're the kinds of range of questions, answers you can have. He was mad because he thought he was God, and generally people who think they're God are mad. Or he was bad, he knew he wasn't, but he put himself out of that way so as to actually gain things from people. Or, I mean, he was a liar, even though he taught people to tell the truth and has persuaded truth-telling to become part of our cultural norm. Or he was a lunatic, though a saner man's teaching you're hard to find. Or he was a legend, you know, something happened way back then. Obviously something must have happened, but it's all got bigger and bigger as the years have rolled on, and he's now risen from the dead, although things like the resurrection from the dead are in the very earliest documents we have. Or he's the Lord. It's this issue that Richard Dawkins quite rightly turns to in his book that is doing the rounds at the moment, the book The God Delusion. Dawkins chooses to go with the legend alternative and gives his reasons why he doubts the historicity of the New Testament. For me, I think this is the weakest part of his book that I've come across so far. It demonstrates basically to me that Professor Dawkins is a scientist with little interest in history, and especially New Testament history, or the history of New Testament studies. I would encourage all Christians to read Professor Dawkins and his critique, just as I would encourage all non-Christians to read the Christian responses that are now coming out to Professor Dawkins' critique. Professor McGrath from Oxford University is producing one that is coming out, and to the Christians I'd say, read Dawkins. To the non-Christians I'd say, read the alternative, because you need to test what you believe, not reinforce what you believe. You need to see the evidences against what you believe, not just reinforce yourself by your side of the argument. A useful scholarly introduction to the history of New Testament studies, it's not a response to Dawkins because it was written a long time ago, is Stephen Neill's masterly study, The Interpretation of the New Testament, 1861 to 1961. Dead boring title, but actually quite a fascinating read. Published by Oxford. It's been updated by N.T. Wright, who's moved it on to 1988. It's really helpful because it helps you see the kinds of oppositions that have happened to Christianity over more than a 100-year period now, if you get the later edition, 120-odd-year period, and you see one hypothesis raised and then brought down after another over a long period of time. And then you see the cumulative end point of what we know as a result of 100 years of scholarly interpretation and investigation into the New Testament. It's a masterly book, and I'd encourage you, if you want to find out more at that academic level, it's a great one to read. But this research will only provide modern answers to the question, who do people say that I am? Not the answer that Jesus was after, because you'll notice in verse 29, Jesus changes the question. To who do you say that I am? The emphasis of the Greek is brought out in this translation that we have before us tonight. What about you? Who do you say that I am? Now, that is a different question. It's a different kind of question. It's an existential question now, not an academic one, for it tells you more about the person who's answering than it does about Jesus. You see, Who did England vote for at the last election? Well, I could ask anybody here in the room and you could tell me. The majority voted for Labour or voted for Tony Blair. But if I were to ask you, who did you vote for at the last election? Then you may well answer, that's none of your business. It's a secret ballot. Because I'm not really asking anything about Tony Blair and the government and Westminster. I'm asking something about you when I ask that question, aren't I? So when I say, who do people say Jesus is? Well, you can write a whole book on the history of who people said Jesus is. But when I say, who do you say Jesus is? We're now going to find out something about you. So again, we read the ancient answer. Peter said, you are the Christ, the long-awaited Messiah, the King of Israel, who was going to come and set up the kingdom that would reign forever over all the peoples of the world. You are the King. You are the Christ, the Messiah. But again, of course, that's the ancient answer of somebody else. What about the modern answer? Who do you think? Not somebody else. Not who do others think Jesus is. Not who do the apostles think Jesus is. Not who do your parents think Jesus is. Not who do the people in your church or your mosque or your synagogue think Jesus is. Who do you think Jesus is? And when you answer that question, get ready for the next question. How do you know? On what basis have you come to that conclusion? Whatever the conclusion, what's the basis for it? Now, for some people tonight, in a sense, that's as far as you can go, and it's now time to get off the train and stand on the station. Because you now know you actually haven't got a basis for the answer. You've never really worked it out. I mean, you've just got your feeling, your inkling, but it would be an embarrassment if somebody actually was to cross-examine you on how you came to your conclusion, because it's just rank prejudice. Or little snippets of information you've heard here and there, but you've never read anything on the subject. Now, if that is the case, then I want you to sign up. Sign up for the course that we're running. I want you to be reading more. Don't wimp out intellectually at that point. Don't use your present ignorance as excuse for doing nothing. If you cannot go further with this passage because you don't know really who Jesus is, then take action and find out who he is. The next action to take is keep listening, even as we go on. Keep listening and learn more about his claims and come again tomorrow and Friday and Saturday and find out. For having received the right answer from Peter, Jesus then starts to explain why he has come into the world. Notice verse 31, he then began to teach them. Up until this stage in the gospel, he hasn't been teaching them why he's come, but now he starts teaching them. And he does it by telling them to tell nobody that he is the Christ. He can't afford that information to get out. Because people's expectation of the Christ was a militaristic conqueror who would lead Israel in war against Rome. That wasn't what he came to do. But as soon as he was called the Christ, the crowds would gather with their armaments to take on Rome. So he said, keep it quiet. And he then uses another phrase, the Son of Man, to talk about himself. The Son of Man's a funny phrase, really. In Aramaic, it's a way of talking about oneself, the third person, impersonal. One can talk about oneself if one wants to, but one sounds a little strange when one does, and one expected to be bitten by one's corgis. Because it's just, you know who it's referring to, but it's an odd way of talking. It was also used in the Old Testament to emphasize somebody's humanity. Ezekiel, Son of Man, stand up, says God. What is man that you care for him, or the Son of Man that you think of him in Psalm 8? It's a way of emphasizing humanity. And also in the Old Testament, in the book Daniel chapter 7, it was used as a strange figure who on the judgment day at the end of the world would come to God and would be given all authority to rule over all nations for all time. He's nameless. We're not sure who he is, where he comes from. He just comes in the cloud to the Ancient of Days at that critical moment in the judgment in order to become the world ruler forever. There are the three background usages to Son of Man. It was therefore a very useful, ambiguous kind of expression. No one else was going to pack the information in. When Jesus talked about himself as the Son of Man, well, he's talking about himself, one does, if one wants to, and he's talking about the fact that he's a man, which is quite clear he is. Could he mean he's the world ruler at the end of the age? Well, that's unlikely, isn't it? Especially in verse 31, when he says the Son of Man must suffer many things, be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, that he must be killed. And after 3 days rise again, he spoke plainly about this to them. This would have been impossible for the Jewish Christ. This blew up all preconceptions that they had. Rejected by Israel's leaders, you're the Christ of Israel. Suffering and killed, you're the conquering Christ. It's an impossible plan for the Christ. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Look, mate, you're the Christ. You're the ruler of the world. Let me tell you what you need to do. It's classic, isn't it? We love Peter. He opens his mouth to change feet regularly. At one moment he is saying, you are the Christ, and he's got it right. At the next moment he's sounding like Satan. He's got it so wrong. But Jesus said, no, he had to suffer and be rejected, killed, and rise. For that is what Jesus predicted in verse 31. The Son of Man must suffer, be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise from the dead. If you believe Jesus is a prophet, this is what he prophesied. In every document we have from the New Testament and in every copy of the transmitted text, he continually prophesies this one thing, that is, he is to be killed. That is the prophecy of Jesus. You can't have him as a prophet and ignore his universally testified prophecy, namely, he's going to be killed. It's a bizarre prophecy. The king is coming to coronation by execution. The disciples didn't understand it for many months, and repeatedly Jesus had to explain it to his disciples, as we saw last night through chapters 8, 9, 10. This is the theme of the Gospel of Mark. It was culminating in the verse that I drew your attention to last night. The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. This is why he came, to give his life as a ransom for many. Not to establish the kingdom like a world kingdom by military power or economic dominance or cultural imperialism, but to free humans from our bondage to evil that I spoke of the first night from Mark 7. Our bondage to the devil and to death. And so he came to die for us in our place, as our substitute, as our ransom. For many people here tonight, again, this is about as far as you can go. This is the next train station to get off on. For we need to understand our own evil if we're ever going to appreciate what God has done for us. If, like Adam, you think that Christianity is about doing things for Christ, you really need to get off the train station now and start thinking about what Christ has done for you. Because it's the other way around, as Adam discovered. Many people, of course, are still sufficiently wet behind the ears not to realise how evil they are. Time will tell. The trouble is, by the time tells, you don't want to hear about Christ. Learn early. And so many people don't appreciate the captivity that they are in and the need for ransom. Many, many people think that, I know I'm not perfect, but if I tried a little bit harder, I could be as moral as God wants me to be. It's a complete nonsense, friends. It will not happen. You will not try harder. And if you do, you will fail. But it's very hard for people to believe that, especially middle-class English people. That's why on Monday night I spoke on chapter 7 about our captivity and immorality, and last night about our ransom, and the CDs can be got from our stall out there, or you can download from the website of KickU to find out more. But you need to consider your morality and your mortality if you're going to understand why Jesus came. But again, I'd say keep listening tonight and the rest of the week, because we will show more and more as we come down to look at the death of Jesus what it meant for him to ransom, to die in our place as our substitute. On Friday night and Saturday night especially, as we look at the death of Jesus in some detail, tomorrow night we'll be looking more at what it is he requires of us. But when people understand who Jesus is, and when people understand why he came, the what he requires of us starts to make sense. For if he is the Christ, then what he requires of us is our lives. And if he has come to pay the penalty for us as our substitute, to free us from death and from evil, then what he requires of us is our lives. For he called the crowd, you'll see there in the next verse, the crowd and the disciples to hear his call. It's not a private teaching just for the disciples. This is for everybody. If you want to be his follower, this is what you must do. Three things, he says. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. Verse 34, then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, follow me. These are not Philip Jensen's rules in order to become a Christian. This is Jesus' rules in order to become a Christian. This is what he required of us. To deny means to say no. If I deny myself an ice cream, I say no to an ice cream. I don't think that is ever likely to have happened, but it's conceivable. If I deny an accusation, I say no, that's not true of me. If I deny myself, I'm saying no to self. No to self-rule, no to self-government, no to selfishness, no to living life the Sinatra way, my way. No to self is what is required. And secondly, take up your cross. The cross was a barbaric exhibition of power, killing people for show. Outside the city, they were strung up there to die in order to warn people not to rebel as these people have. It's like being impaled by Vlad, or drawn and quartered and hung up for people to be seen what will happen to you. The Roman system was that you were given the crosspiece to carry out to the stake that was already there. And the person who was carrying the crosspiece out to the stake, to the place of execution, was therefore declared to be the convicted and dead man who had lost all rights. And so, like being placed in medieval stocks, the crowd would come around and sport with him. We don't have public executions these days. In our country, we don't have them at all, and I don't think you do in yours, do you? But we don't have them. But you notice the other day there was a public execution. Well, it was a private execution of Saddam Hussein. And you notice the horror that we had in our Western media, that the people who executed him yelled abuse at him at the very point of him dying. It is horrible. It is dreadful. And yet, if you knew the history of executions, it was completely normal. Public executions have been great festivities and great times of public joy as crowds gather to see the event. Huge crowds gather. And there's much merriment and much joy, especially with somebody the crowd hates. And so those who are being executed, carrying out the cross, were at the mercy of the crowd for some length of time before they were finally strung up to die over 2 or 3 days in ignominious pain and shame. So said Jesus, if you want to be my disciple, you've got to say no to self and take up the cross. That will mean your rejection by the world and your rejection of the world as you head towards your death. And follow me, physically on the way to Jerusalem, but follow me to the way of death. Live my way, the way of death and resurrection. That is, what Jesus requires, to put it in the Australian vernacular, is that we drop dead. You can see it in the text, for if you look at the next verse, verse 35, it says it in non-Australian. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Verse 35, starting with the word for, is explanatory of verse 34. To take up your cross, to deny yourself, take up your cross, and to follow Jesus was to lose your life for Jesus and the gospel's sake. It was to drop dead for Jesus. If this is the Christ who has come to be the ransom price for us, the man who is going to die in our place and rise again to rule the world, then this is a right thing for us to do. If this man is a madman, then it is the wrong thing to do. If he's a liar, then it's the wrong thing to do. If he didn't die on the cross for us, but it's the wrong thing to do. Who he is and why he's come determines what he requires of us. But here in the next place, people want to get off the train. For there'll be people who say, well, look, I'm happy enough that I know he was the Christ, and I can believe that he died and rose again for me. But I can't believe that I still can't run my own life my own way. I mean, can't I just accept this is true and go to church occasionally? I mean, can't I be believing this and still do what I want to do? Why do I have to drop dead? Why do I have to be one of those pilloried, persecuted Christians? Can't I continue to do the course I'm doing and get the career I'm going to have and the wife or the husband and the children and the two dogs and the cows, the house and the cat and the cars and the... Why do I have to give up everything for him? Which brings us to the fourth point, why? Why should I do it? And Jesus gives three reasons. First reason, first argument is, verse 36, profit. What profit? What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? The word good here means gain, profit, benefit. What have you got? You know it's true. You know who Jesus is and why he came and what he requires. But you want to hang on to your own life, not give it up to him. Why? What's so special about your life? What is it that you've got that you couldn't let go of, that's so important to you that you wouldn't let go of? Is it the house? Is it the career? Is it the water view that you're going to have in your holiday house? Is it the overseas trip? Is it rising up in the company? Is it founding your own company? Is it losing your family? Is it stepping away from them? What is it about your life that you have got that is so important that you will not let go of? Have we not read over and over again the stories of the rich and famous in all their misery? Survey after survey shows us that we as a society are richer than our forefathers and unhappier than our forefathers. Don't you understand that life is but a long queue to the crematorium? I know most of you are English, and so you believe in standing in queues. You are experts in it. But have a little look where the queue ends. Don't just stand. It might be the wrong queue. Run up and see that it's actually going to come to the counter you want it to go to, because it's a very long queue, this one. And I tell you what's up at the end of this queue: the crematorium, the ashes, your ashes, the ones that Australians can't take from you, the real ashes. You're at the end of the crematorium, going up the flue and delivering to your family later. Little plastic box, it's about that big. It rattles because the shin bones don't actually completely go into ashes. I've buried many of them, I know them. There they are. That's what you are going to be. Now, what is there in your queue existence that's so important for you, that you want to hang on to? What are you going to do in the queue? What games are you going to play in the queue that are somehow going to justify your existence? You may think it's a long way off, and in some ways it is a long way off, because it's a long, long queue, but what is there in it? The Sydney Morning Herald wrote about one of my fellow countrymen back in 2005. Natasha Circa wrote it, who's a media and policy consultant. And she wrote, "I was saddened to hear that Kylie Minogue, singing budgie, gay icon, everyone's neighbour with an estimated worth of $100 million, aged just 36, has breast cancer. Sad, in the way that you can never be happy to hear that kind of news about someone you don't know, unless they're on your short list of baddies. A pop diva, showgirl Kylie, she may be, but a baddie she isn't. The worst that you could call her is disproportionately rich and cute. In wishing Kylie luck, let's understand that her illness is a serious news in a way that we may not realise. It's a timely reminder of how fragile and ultimately useless all the status, fame, career, milestones, megabucks and other trophies on the mantelpiece can prove to be. When you've got cancer or any other life-threatening illness, what you need is the people who really know and love you to be right there, to hold your hand while you're throwing up after treatment, and to buy you scarves when your hair falls out, and promise to look after the people you love most the same way you do when you're gone, if it comes to that. You also need everyone else to get a grip. If I were Kylie, in Kylie's medical shoes, and at her age, which the writer says I could be, I think I'd want a bit less anxious, anal focus from the 30-something crowd on the things that we might not even live to see come to fruition, like mortgages and superannuation spreadsheets and kitchen renovations on the next investment property, or the resolution of debates over which private school is the best for our unborn children. I'd want my peers to take a few more risks so that they get to live a little and a little more in the moment. I'd want them to throw more parties on a whim, where people dance on tables and wear gold hot pants and fool around and drink out of Cynthia and play a whole lot more Kylie records really, really loud. How pathetic. You see, face to face with death, when you get a jump up the queue, and it's not way, way, way there, somebody else is going to die, it doesn't happen to me, it hasn't yet, never will. When you actually get a jump on the queue like cancer and you can see what is there, then what are the options? All your achievements, all your medals, all your fame, they're pretty useless in the crematorium. All your plans, like the mortgage and the children's ed, that's really an irrelevance too. No, the two things that you can hope for is to have your family around to hold your hand so that to make the grieving all the more exquisitely painful. So what's there left? Eat, drink and be merry. Gold hot pants. Go out. Rage. The crematorium, your ashes, are the starting point of a philosophy of life. Because it is the only one fixed certainty about your life. Nothing else is certain. You can fall on the steps on the way out tonight, have brain damage and never be the same again. Nothing is certain about your future except what's at the end of the queue. That's the one certainty. So if your philosophy of life has not actually been built and taken into account that certainty, then your philosophy of life, frankly, dear friend, is not worth having, because it's not based on the one fact we know: our death, our mortality. Woody Allen said, "I'm very proud of my pocket watch. My grandfather, on his deathbed, sold it to me." I knew a man who was on his deathbed with his family around him. Wealthy man who provided all that they needed. And yet on his deathbed he was phone trading on the stock market, even the day he died. He was still trading, right to the end of the queue. Can't take your stocks with you. Can't take your shares with you. Really didn't matter. He was so engaged in the game he was playing that he really didn't take into account where the end of the game was. There's many fascinations in life, pleasures, enjoyments, games we can play in the queue. But where's it going? So how much land does a man need is a title of a story that Tolstoy told. Let me give it to you briefly and unfairly to Tolstoy. Go and read the original. It's about a man, a poor man, who gathers up all his family possessions in because he hears there's a land ground in the steppes of Russia. And it's his one chance to get ahead. And so he travels across Russia to this place. And the principle of the land grant was that you set out at sunup and you came back to the same point at sundown. And whatever you encircled in that period of time was yours. Because it was critical that you had to be back at the original point. Otherwise no one would know how much was yours. So he sets out, he evaluates, he works out where the land is. He's very careful in his all his calculations. He knows that if he reaches a certain point at a certain time of the day, then it's worth going around a swamp because there's really valuable ground on the other side. But if he doesn't reach there by that time, go the short way because you'll miss out and never get back. When he gets there, he's on time, so he strips off more of his luggage and car and food and the rest, and he goes around the swamp in order to get in the best land, and he runs and runs, and he just keeps on stripping off more and more so that he can get there. And when he gets back to the hill from which he started, as he gets to the foot of the hill, the sun falls behind the horizon and he has missed out on everything. And he falls down, collapsed on the ground, utterly exhausted. And as he lies there, heaving and panting, he hears the people who set him out in the first place jeering at him and laughing at him and making fun of him. And if it's not bad enough that he's missed everything, he's having to face this. And as he looks up at them, he realizes they're not jeering him, they're cheering him. They're calling upon him to keep coming because up on the top of the hill, they can still see the sun. And so with his last superhuman effort that he can muster, he gets up and he runs up the hill chasing the sun as he goes up the hill. And he arrives at the top of the hill just to see the sun and the last couple of rays. And so he has succeeded, he's accomplished, he's got it all. And he falls down utterly, utterly exhausted. And his heart breaks. He dies right there at their feet. See, Tolstoy is asking the question, how much land does a man need? And there's this terrible answer at the end of the story. 6 feet by 2 feet is all that you need. Just enough for your coffin. That's how much you need. And in our modern technological society, it's about 3 inches by 5 inches. So we can put you in a wall, along with all the other ones, in the wall. So Jesus then gives a second reason, if that's not enough, which is like the first. What exchange is there? See it, verse 37. What will a man give in exchange for his life? However rich you are, however well educated you are, however famous you become, death will not be cheated. You will die and it will end your wealth and your education and your fame, and frankly the size of your headstone will not be able to take in all the things you want to write on it. And if you put all your qualifications and all your experiences and all your conquests on your headstone, it'll be written so small no one will be able to read it. But don't worry, friends, no one wants to anyway. What matters? Matter on your headstone. This death subject that I'm speaking of, you see, is a taboo subject in our conversation, in our education, in our society. We will never address death. Don't believe me? Next time you go to a dinner party, turn to your hostess and say, "Have you been considering your mortality lately?" Ask the host, "Have you made funeral arrangements yet, or are you just waiting for the family to sort this out? Have you thought about death?" Ask that at a party when everybody's in their gold lame hot paints and playing Kylie at the top of their noise. Say, "Have you been thinking about death, have you? I hear you've got a Kylie record on. Must be death that has got you playing that." What exchange would you give? Those who do consider death, like the existentialists, like the theatre of the absurd, like Camus, Sartre, Beckett, Pinter, it makes life meaningless and futile. To be lived to the full in party rage or stupidity as we wait for Godot. For there is nobody that can cheat death, and death makes everything that you do cheap and useless. So what is it that you will hang on to in this life that is worth sacrificing all that Jesus is offering you? Just a girlfriend? A friend in the school days that I shared the gospel with. He wouldn't become a Christian because the girl he really loved and wanted to go out with was hostile to Christianity. So he chose her rather than Christ. Ah, stupid idea. About 2 months later, she dropped him. Then how do you turn back to Christ? "Oh, well, I'm sorry. Now the girl won't have me. I was thinking of coming back to you." How do you do that? What's so important? Getting drunk? Terrible, terrible infliction upon our society. The choice of drug that is so common. Alcohol, it so dehumanizes, it so destroys. But the binge drinking, young man I knew, big man, huge man, he was a linesman with the telegraph system. He wanted to become a Christian, he was desperate to be a Christian like his mum. I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning sitting with him, having spent all day, he just sobbing. He was about 6'5". He was sobbing because he couldn't face Thursday night as a Christian. Because Thursday night, we always get drunk. I couldn't work with those men all day and not go and get drunk with them on Thursday nights. Is that worth exchanging your soul, your life? What is it that is going to be so important to you that you'd say, "Oh, no, I couldn't give that up"? To climb up the corporate ladder? What price do you put on your soul? But Jesus gives a third and final reason why. For rest assured, who is ashamed of Jesus in this world, Jesus will be ashamed of him when he comes in the judgment of the end times. For Jesus is the Son of Man, not just the human, but also the Son of Man who comes in the clouds with glory in the day of judgment. Look at verse 38. If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory and the holy angels. If you know the truth, then live the truth. If you know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of Man, who has died to free you from judgment and will return as the King, then give your whole life to him. Do not worry what the world thinks. Do not worry what it costs you. Do not fear what other people fear. Many have made this change. And we'll tell you later that's the wisest thing they've ever done. How can you make such a change? Well, in one sense, you can't. And that's why I draw your attention to this prayer. Because God can change you, while you can't change yourself. So just take a moment and look at the prayer that I'm going to lead in a few moments' time. And I've asked each night, and thank you so much for doing this, it's really helpful not just to the others around you but to me, that you also take hold of the little card. And I'm going to give you a minute to read through this prayer, to know whether it is you want to be praying it or not, but also to be writing here. Just give you this minute to tick the boxes at the front, to work out what you're going to do. Did you get off the train back at the station about you didn't know who Jesus was? Well, what are you going to do about it? Did you get off the train not knowing why Jesus came? Well, what are you going to do about it? Do you know it's true, but you've never actually taken the action of giving your life to him? What are you going to do about it? Pray the prayer? Join up with the Christianity examined course? What are you going to do about it? Write a note or comment to me if you like. I've read them all again today. Thank you. Thank you for the minor corrections that I make. There's many verbal slips I have. Yes, it's Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Yes, it's Lord Hattersley, not Baron. But I'm happy for you to correct me. It's perfectly all right. Just slips of the tongue of an old man. I'm happy to hear what you've got to say, and I read them all. So take a minute, without my voice, filling out the card and working out whether tonight you should give all to the Lord Jesus Christ. One of your comments last night was, gee, a minute's a long time. It's not long compared to eternity. That's what we're talking about here. It's life. See the prayer? Three elements to it. The first one is the acknowledgement in that first paragraph of our need for forgiveness. Do you need to be forgiven? If you don't know that about yourself, you really are dull. You don't know anything. Second paragraph is thanking God for sending his son to die for me and rising again. Do you know that Jesus is the one sent by God to do that? If you don't know that, then you can't be praying this prayer now. It wouldn't be honest, would it? You need to be finding out about that. Come to the courses. But if you do know that, well then the prayer is the third paragraph. Please forgive me. I need forgiveness. Jesus dies for my forgiveness. Please forgive me. But what Jesus requires of me is much more still, isn't it? And change me that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. I've got to say no to self, take up my cross, and follow him. That's what he said. I've got to lose my life for his sake, and the Gospels. That's what he said. And so we pray, change me, that I might live Jesus as my ruler. See where the prayers come from? Just out of the Gospels. Well now, let me pray it out loud. And if you want to pray it in the quietness of your own mind to God with me. Dear God, I know that I'm not worthy to be accepted by you. I don't deserve your gift of eternal life. I am guilty of rebelling against you and ignoring you, and I need forgiveness. Thank you for sending your son to die for me that I may be forgiven. Thank you that he rose from the dead to give me new life. Please forgive me and change me that I may live with Jesus as my ruler. Amen. Friends, if that is your prayer, then he will forgive you. He's died to forgive you. He will forgive you. Whatever it is you've done, he will forgive you. And if that is your prayer, he will change you. But it's very important that you get to talk to Christians about it, that you debrief about it, work out about it now. Go on that sheet there
Amongst others, you'll see the box which says, I am praying to become a Christian. So if that is your prayer, that you're starting the Christian life, then please tick the box, put your name, college, email, details down there, so that we can come and talk to you confidentially about it. We'd love to help you at this point in time. Newborn babies are not left out in the cold. They need help. And if this is your prayer, then you are being born again. And you need help. So make sure that you do that. On the door on the way out, you drop this in the box. On the door on the way out, you pick up the advertisement, which is here somewhere in my notes, for the cross-examined that is coming up. Two things to be doing, but Barney's going to tell us the other things that I have forgotten to tell us that we should be doing. Because I always do forget, and I just got to keep talking here long enough for him to get here. You are taking longer each night.
Thanks very much, Philip. Well, I guess we've had some tough stuff there, and I guess all of us have got some questions. So can I invite us all to stay on around just to chat afterwards? The small hall will be opened up with some tables.